Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. This hour of the program, we're talking with the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. 100 days. We know the ending, the horrible ending of those 100 days. Actually, it was 50 years ago today that John and Jackie Kennedy's infant son, Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, died. An event of the summer of 1963 that was, according to JFK, one of the most difficult moments of his life. The summer of 1963, though, according to our guest, was quite a remarkable summer for the president. Thurston Clark is with us. He is also the author of The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy in 82 Days That Inspired America, Ask Not, The Inauguration of JFK and the Speech That Changed America, also author of Pearl Harbor Ghosts, the basis for a CBS documentary, and his bestseller, Lost Hero, a biography of Raoul Wallenberg that was made into an NBC miniseries. He has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other publications. We'll talk about so many issues: the test ban treaty, what the president really thought about Vietnam, what his thoughts were about the civil rights movement, his relationship with Martin Luther King. Very interesting chapter on Robert Frost and how mad JFK was at Robert Frost, and we'll find out why that was the case. The Kennedy family, Kennedy's womanizing, and how damaging that was and inexplicable to those who knew him well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Thurston. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can also send us a tweet at K Dunn Show. Thurston Clark, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, hello. It's great to be with you.
So I believe it was 50 years ago today that Jack and Jackie's infant son, Patrick, died, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He was called up to Otis Air Force Base in Cape Cod, where Jackie was she was spending the summer at a house near Hyannisport that they'd rented. And she went into labor, I think, about 7 weeks prematurely. And the boy was born through cesarean section. Jack got there just after he'd been born. And he was told right away that the boy was in trouble. You know, nowadays, somebody's born premature. If a baby was born premature, that prematurely, he would almost certainly survive. But then things were much more rudimentary.
You talk about this being a loss that shattered the president and Jackie, but it also brought them together.
It certainly did. Jack was with his son Patrick for most of the 36 hours the boy was alive. And in fact, when he died, JFK was holding his hand. He burst into tears afterwards. He cried again at the funeral. When he came to give Jackie the news, he burst into tears at her bedside. And then after he came back from the funeral, he said to her, he knelt down by her bed. And then after he finally recovered and had stopped weeping, he said, "You know, Jackie, we must not let this grief continue. This would not be good for the American people, or for the work we have to do." And that phrase, "the work we have to do," something that really caught her attention, according to Jackie's mother, because it was the first time that he was voicing their marriage in the White House as a partnership in which she had an important role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then after this, as I detail in the book, there are a number of clues and things that happen and things that Jackie says that show them becoming much closer than they had been.
What was striking to me is I was reading this, and it's interesting to read this book right before the 50th anniversary of the assassination, was he was talking to her about how the nation can't see them sad. There can't be this sadness about the White House and the incredible sadness that followed 90 days later.
That's right. But, of course, we have to remember that she remained kind of determinedly dry-eyed in public.
Yes.
So maybe she was remembering this. And there's a moment that I talk about in the book where, as she's packing to leave the White House, all of her staff is crying. And she turns to her maid, Providencia, and says, Provi, now is not the time to cry. We'll cry later.
Tell me about the summer you describe, and maybe he said this, that the summer of 1963, this, of course, was a horrendous event. But some of the other events of 1963 were, he thought, the highlight of his life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Before Patrick was born, he told his friend Dave Powers that he was having a marvelous summer. He called the July 4th weekend the best weekend of my life. He'd had this triumphant tour to Germany and Ireland, where he'd been greeted by huge crowds. He'd given his Ich bin ein Berliner speech to over a million people in Berlin. And as they left, he said to Ted Sorensen, we'll never have a day like this one as long as we live. Mm. And the summer had really started with two very important speeches that he gave back-to-back on June 10th and 11th. The first is American University speech, when he called for negotiations for a test ban treaty. And the second, his ad-libbed civil rights speech the next day, announcing that he was going to submit a civil rights bill to Congress. So he was finally doing some of the brave things that a lot of his supporters had hoped for and hadn't seen in the first 2 years of his presidency.
Let's talk more about the civil rights movement, because there have been differing perspectives on how close he took this to heart, how important this issue was to him, or whether or not it was important to him. You write that indeed it was, that when the March on Washington took place, he's looking out the window and saying, I don't know who he was saying it to, I wish I could be out there as well.
Yeah, he was saying it to an African-American, one of the employees at the White House, one of the doormen. And he said, his name was Preston Bruce, and he said, oh, Bruce, I wish I could be out there with them. He could hear the strains of We Shall Overcome and the singing from the Lincoln Memorial. He was standing on the third floor of the White House. You have to remember that Kennedy had really disappointed King and a lot of the civil rights leaders in the first 2 years. He hadn't submitted the kind of bill to Congress, civil rights bill to Congress. He'd done some things. He'd increased the hiring of African Americans in the federal government. There had been some progress, but it was really the brutal attacks on demonstrators in Birmingham in the spring of 1963 that I think moved him to action. And after he gave his speech, in which he referred to civil rights being a moral question, which is what King had hoped he was going to do all along. When King heard it, he turned to an aide and said, that white man really hit the ball out of the park. Hmm. And James Farmer of CORE called it the strongest speech on civil rights given by any president, Lincoln included.
Hmm. Did he lack some of LBJ's skills in moving things through Congress? Can he be criticized for not having that kind of skill?
You know, I think that he would have moved the civil rights bill through, maybe not as quickly as LBJ did, because LBJ had the assassination factor as well working for him. There's a quote in the book that I give from Paul Samuelson, the economist who was an advisor to Kennedy, who refers to him being actually a very timid politician who was always checking the ice in front of him. And that is certainly, I think, a fair criticism of Kennedy in the first 2 years, although we have to remember that he only won the presidency by 125,000 popular votes in the popular votes. He did better in Electoral College. So he felt that he couldn't move ahead. He wasn't that much of a profile in courage, but as I say in the book, that all changed in the summer of 63 with those two speeches. And then he was determined to get the limited test ban treaty ratified through the Senate, and was pushing hard to get the civil rights bill through Congress. And in fact, before Dallas, he'd succeeded in getting it through the House Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm. And the test ban treaty, important to him because we almost were on the brink of nuclear war?
Well, it's important to him because of what had happened the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he felt that we were very close to a nuclear war, and that sobered him and Khrushchev. It was very sobering development, and that really led to the test ban treaty. Also, there was a secret correspondence going on after the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 62, right through the end of his presidency with Nikita Khrushchev. You know, we've kind of forgotten the fact that there was, you know, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was the first agreement to regulate nuclear arms since the beginning of the Cold War. And we've kind of forgotten that it led to a real detente in the fall of 1963. But I think the assassination is kind of a black hole that swallowed a lot of Kennedy's accomplishments and a lot of the things that happened in the 100 days before he was killed. The detente didn't just involve the Test Ban Treaty. There was the hotline between Moscow and Washington. There was Kennedy approving the sale of wheat to the Soviet Union. And Kennedy was willing to really to forget about beating the Russians to the moon. And in a famous speech to the United Nations that was black banner headline to the New York Times and Washington Post, he proposed a joint moon mission with American and Soviet cosmonauts, or Soviet cosmonauts and American astronauts going to the moon together. Because Kennedy was very conflicted about the space program. He thought it was very expensive, and he even said to, we have the tapes now, this conversation to Ambassador Dobrynin from the Soviet Union, that it was just a prestige project, and it really didn't matter, and it wasn't really important. And of course, if he was going to settle the Cold War, which is what he hoped to do, why spend all this money to beat the Russians to the moon? Better to have them go together. So we might have had a situation where Yuri Gagarin and Neil Armstrong would have stepped out of that spacecraft together.
And the course of history may have been changed, huh?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, quite remarkable. There's also an interesting, it's just a side story, except that when you talk about Khrushchev, it reminded me of the chapter on Robert Frost and their frosty relations for something that Frost had done, and then also a speech that Kennedy gave, I believe, in October, dedicating the Frost Library. It's a fascinating story. I had never heard it before.
Well, what happened was, of course, Frost was supposed to deliver a speech, was supposed to deliver a poem at the inaugural address, the inauguration. And the sun, the glare of the sun was so bright that he couldn't read the poem he'd written, so he recited a poem. 2 days later that he knew from memory, 2 days later he goes to the White House. He gives Kennedy the poem that he's written. And the last words are, the last lines are, a golden age of poetry and power of which this noonday is the beginning hour. Hmm. And Frost gives this to Kennedy as he's leaving the room. He says, poetry and power is the formula for another Augustan age. Be more Irish than Harvard. And it wasn't until really 63 that Kennedy, when Kennedy wrote him a thank you note, at the bottom he wrote in his own hand, it's poetry and power all the way. But as I say in the book, it really wasn't, he didn't really marry the poetry of his words to the power of the presidency until 1963, until the summer of 63. Now, you're right, he had a falling out with Frost in 62. Frost went to the Soviet Union, and when he came back, he said some made some ill-advised comments. He was an older man. I don't think he realized what he was saying. Repeated that Khrushchev had said that the United States was too frightened to fight or too liberal to fight. And Kennedy just went ballistic and refused to take calls from him when he was on his deathbed. And he tried to make up for that. He gave a speech at the inauguration of the Frost Library in Amherst. And in that speech, he talked about poetry and power. And he also even said, Frost once told me to be more Irish than Harvard. And we've tried to follow that advice.
Mm. And let's talk about the Irish part, if you'll bear with me for a moment, because I kind of like Ireland as well, but it was interesting to me that he considered those days some of the best days of that summer as well, and that when he came back, he made people watch the home movies of Ireland over and over and over.
Over again and over again until finally they watched them 4th of July weekend so many times that finally only Teddy would watch with him anymore. And he was kind of a bore about it. But it really was. And also, he used to say to people within Jackie's hearing, I believe, that those were the three best days of his life. Well, there were 3 days that Jackie wasn't present for, so I don't know how she took that. But no, he had a very emotional connection to Ireland, and in fact, he had the Irish prime minister coming over for a state visit in October that he went to, and it was again there was a lot of Irish songs at a party in the private quarters of the White House afterwards, and he was seen tearing up.
Hmm. And he gave some lovely speeches there off the cuff. His humor was very present in Ireland, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. You know, I think it brought out the best of him. He was very, very loose. He was also seeing relatives. The famous time when he went to see Mary Ryan, who was a cousin, or I can't remember, their second cousin. And when he went there, he discovered that the American ambassador had decided that her dirt yard wasn't grand enough for him, so he paved it over. And Kennedy was absolutely outraged, because for all of his wealth and everything else, he was really, he hated ostentation and stuff. And he flew into a fury afterwards and said that he was going to make the ambassador take all the concrete out, pay for it out of his own pocket. But of course, like a lot of the things he threatened to do when he got angry, he quickly forgot about it.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Thurston Clark is with us. He's the author of a fascinating book about Kennedy. It's JFK's Last 100 Days. It's hard to believe. I was alive. I remember that day vividly, 50 years ago, November 22nd, when he was assassinated. And there's something haunting about reading these last months of JFK's life. It was a very productive and profoundly interesting summer. And then, of course, the book gets into the preparations for Dallas and Adlai Stevenson's visit, and Jackie paying attention to that, and JFK as well, and all of those what-ifs that you can't help but ask, because we know the outcome. His book is JFK's Last 100 Days, and our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can also send us a tweet. That's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone number for you to join our conversation about JFK's Last 100 Days, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Randy is our first caller. Hi, Randy.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask, I'm a little confused about some of the things that are being portrayed about President Kennedy. And although he did many great things during his term in office, the one very negative thing that I perceived was his complicity in the Bay of Pigs incident. I mean, he almost negotiated the world into a third world war. And I guess I don't understand why people think that this was such a marvelous thing from a man who's supposed to be leading the United States of America, which is noted to be the land of the free and hope and all that. And I'll take comments off air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Randy.
Sure. Randy's talking about the Bay of Pigs, I heard, not the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
The Bay of Pigs came in April of 1961. It was an operation that had been planned by the Eisenhower administration. Kennedy and his advisors approved it. His advisors were virtually unanimous in approving that he go ahead with it. He took advice from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA. He was obviously misled, and he also learned from that never again to make a decision like that without further investigation, without polling everybody in the room and pushing them as to why they should go ahead with it. The Bay of Pigs did not, however, bring us to the edge of nuclear war. That was what happened with the Cuban Missile Crisis a year and a half later. The Bay of Pigs was a real learning experience for JFK. A number of the CIA people were forced into retirement. He got a new got Maxwell Taylor as the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff afterwards. And it also made him extremely suspicious of advice from the generals and from the CIA. And when the Cuban Missile Crisis came around, most of the people's initial reaction was that we should have gone in and bombed the missile sites in Cuba. Kennedy, of course, decided on a blockade. We know now that could have triggered a nuclear war, because the Russians had then, the missiles in Cuba were active, were ready to be fired, and it's my understanding that the local commanders, Russian commanders, had given been given their head to go ahead and retaliate if they were attacked. So I think Randy's right that the Bay of Pigs was certainly shameful start to Kennedy's presidency, but it was an operation that he inherited, and he learned from it and put the lesson to good use a year and a half later with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I was 19 in 1963, and my family has this saying about young people, which is, I mean, it's polite, but it's more sap than sense, meaning that there's so much energy pulsating through young people that they get terribly enthused about politics and other things in general. But I do remember it being such a hopeful time. And Jackie Kennedy was, like, multilingual. She could speak Spanish and French gracefully, and there was this sort of horizon of internationalism associated with the Kennedys. And then the assassination, and a shadow passed over American politics that I don't think we've ever recovered from. And I'm wondering if the author, if Mr. Clark, in his book or elsewhere, thinks that that's just, you know, my sort of weak reminiscence of a youth that was dashed because of the assassination of a president, or if he really sees something in American politics, a cynicism that emerged out of the assassination of an idealistic and useful figure like that.
Yeah, let me answer Richard first of all by saying that after about a year after the assassination, a British journalist who was a close friend of Jackie's came to visit her in her new apartment on Fifth Avenue. And he tried to, Jackie said to him, Bobby tried to comfort me by saying that if Jack had been shot after the Bay of Pigs, he would have been remembered as one of the worst presidents. And the journalist thought that was kind of a strange way to comfort people. But anybody who knew how much Kennedy wanted to make his mark on history and to be considered a great president, that made a lot of sense. As far as the hope goes, I think, again, that the Test Ban Treaty and the Civil Rights Bill really raised the anticipation and hope and optimism in the country in the fall of 1963 to a new level. I mean, we were facing two great threats to the nation then. The first threat was racial conflict, serious racial conflict, race war. The second was nuclear war. And Kennedy was addressing both of those huge threats in the summer and fall of 1963. And I think that that increased the mourning and the horror after the assassination because, Rich is right, it was a time of great optimism, much more optimism than there had been even after the Kennedy's inauguration. I think people felt that he was about on the verge of settling these two problems. You know, the University of Chicago, a week after the assassination, the National Opinion Research Center fanned out, interviewed thousands of Americans, and they found that 56% of Americans admitted to having shed real tears, not just, you know, eyes watered, but cried after Kennedy's assassination. And 30% of white Southerners had even admitted that they had cried. So there was this great, you know, we remember now, we can remember how shocked we were. But at the time, it just came at a time of great hope and great promise. And I think that's what made it, you know, even more difficult.
And then, just a few years later, talk about losing optimism and hope. We get the assassination of Martin Luther King and shortly thereafter Bobby Kennedy.
And then Bobby Kennedy, exactly. My favorite, one of my lines is Abba Ibn, the famous Israeli statesman. After the Kennedy's assassination, he said that tragedy is the difference between what is and what might have been. And he said, given that definition, Kennedy's assassination was one of the most authentically tragic events in the history of nations.
Yeah, it was extraordinarily tragic. Let's spend some time on historians seem to have differing views on this, and I don't know if you can give us a definitive answer to this or not, but you write about Vietnam dominating the final months, that he half-heartedly encouraged a coup that toppled and killed Diem, and seemed to determine to draw down the American presence and avoid a future quagmire there. Let's talk about both of those. Half-heartedly encouraging, what does that mean? And what evidence do you have that he was determined to draw down American presence?
Well, I'll do the American presence first. On October 9th, it was announced. He didn't announce it, but he approved the announcement by Secretary of State McNamara and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Maxwell Taylor, who had just been to Vietnam on a fact-finding mission, that America was going to remove 1,000 advisors by the end of the year with a goal of removing all the American advisors by 1965. Kennedy repeatedly said to his advisors and to friends that he planned to reduce American involvement and that he was not going to send combat units. And that's the crucial thing, because he was asked again and again by George Bundy, who was his national security advisor, Eugene Rostow, by a lot of the Halston administration, came back from Vietnam and would repeatedly say, we need to send combat units there. And Kennedy was the only one who was determined never to send combat units to Vietnam, and he didn't, and that's what Johnson did. As far as the Diem coup, this is a very interesting kind of intersection between Kennedy's personal life and his presidential duties. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. sent Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. to Vietnam as ambassador, and a couple of days later, Lodge sent a cable wanting to know how he should respond to a group of generals who wanted to overthrow Diem. It was a very turbulent time in South Vietnamese history. There had been demonstrations against the Diem regime, which was heavily Catholic. A lot of the key leaders were part of the Catholic minority by the Buddhists. And Kennedy received this cable and was told he had to respond about 10 days after Patrick died. And it was a very sad time in Hyannisport then. Carolyn was acting up because she was very upset about her baby brother dying. It was raining outside. Kennedy kept reading all the condolence letters again and again. And so his mind really wasn't on the ball. So he approved this cable, violating what he had really learned at the Bay of Pigs, which is that you get all your advisors in a room and hash something out and are very skeptical. And then he tried to rescind it 2 days later, but it was too late. The generals had already been given the green light. Now, the generals then backed off, and for the next kind of 6 weeks or 2 months, there was a to-ing and fro-ing about whether the generals were going to go ahead and overthrow Diem. Kennedy's position was not based on morality. It was based on utility. He was ready to have a coup take Diem out, but he didn't want to have a coup that failed.
Mm-hmm.
And up until the last minute, he was demanding that Lodge reassure him that the generals could actually carry through on this thing, which Lodge couldn't do. So it really got out of his hands. You've got to remember, too, that Kennedy was simply not concerned about Vietnam until the summer of 1963, until one of the Buddhist monks poured gasoline on himself, and there's that horrific picture of him in flames. And that seized Kennedy's attention, as did the demonstrations and the violence by the Diem regime against the Buddhists. So suddenly he was focusing on something that had seemed to him to be an unimportant sideshow compared to the Test Ban Treaty and civil rights, and he didn't handle it particularly well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the womanizing, which you write about, and it's hard not to talk about the presidency. And I've never been able to understand this very fully. You write there was one particular affair, which I'll ask you to talk about, that was an egregious instance of a womanizing so compulsive and careless that even those who believe they knew him well would struggle for decades to fathom it. They would say it's inexplicable,
right.
It's incomprehensible. It is, isn't it?
It is. It is. Somebody said there was a compulsion so deep in that man. Sometimes when he tries to explain, there's one part of the book where I talk about he finally one of the people who'd been a woman who'd been on his staff and wasn't anymore was at a dinner party, and she said, "Jack, this was in 1959 or so, 60. When you're straining every gasket to get elected president, how can you keep, you know, doing this? How can you keep this womanizing? And he looked at her, she said, like a little boy who was lost, and he shook his head and said, I just can't help myself.
Hmm.
So, you know, the usual, the most popular explanation is that it had to do with his father, who was also a famous womanizer, and it encouraged him in this regard. And also Kennedy felt that, as he once said to Marie Ritter, who was a family friend of his, but all great men, he said, had this failing. And he went and talked about Woodrow Wilson and Alexander the Great, and seeing this flaw in the kind of sequence of as a kind of historical quality that great men had. I do say in the book, however, that in the final months, there is evidence that he had either curtailed or completely ended his womanizing between the death of Patrick and when he was killed. One of his mistresses, the intern, Mimi Alford, writes in her book that was published a few years ago, that even though she traveled with him and there would have been plenty of opportunity for them to resume their affair, that they never had sexual relations after Patrick died.
Hmm. And yet you could ask the question, well, he was going to be facing re-election. Perhaps he needed to clean up his act.
Well, yes, and I think he was. I think that might have been a motive, but I do think there was something about Patrick's death that had something to do with it, because it happened pretty quickly right after that. And I think also he got a big scare from Ellen Romisch, who was the East German woman who he had had an affair with, who was deported, who could have really caused a lot of problems for Kennedy if she'd been if she'd ever gone public and been subpoenaed by a Senate committee, but that didn't happen.
Yeah. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're speaking this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with Thurston Clark. He is author of JFK's Last 100 Days. And Ann is our next caller in Harvard. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
His assassination occurred on my birthday, my 8th birthday, so mm-hmm. I remember an awful lot. And then, of course, because we have, you know, examined everything that happened so much, you know, I remember everything that took place. It was unspeakably tragic. My question is, does your guest feel that he understands Kennedy's character enough to say how he may have responded to college students and young people who formed a movement against the war later in Johnson's time, the kinds of things that happened at Kent State and so on, things like that?
Well, I am convinced that part of the 60s and wouldn't have occurred, because I'm convinced that he would not have sent combat units into Vietnam. We wouldn't have had 500,000 combat troops there the way we did with Johnson. And I'm not alone in that. Every single one of his advisors who were key in kind of advising Johnson, and I'm talking about National Security Advisor George Bundy and Maxwell Taylor, as well as Clark Clifford, who later became Johnson's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, have all said, Governor Connally as well, have all said that they didn't think that Kennedy would ever have sent combat units into American combat units into Vietnam. And one of the reasons was that he and his brother visited Vietnam in 1951, and he could see what was happening to the French, and he vowed and never to have it happen to the United States. And he said this private to a number of people to explain his opposition to combat units. So I think without combat units, without the involvement that Johnson had, the escalation, I don't think there would have been the protest that we saw against Vietnam. And the book has a pretty complete analysis of this. A lot of this information has only become public in the last 10 to 15 years. It wasn't known 20, 25 years ago. So it's somewhat new information, and I think it confirms that we would have missed a lot of the traumas of the 60s.
Anything else, Ann?
No, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Ann.
I just wanted to have one more thing for Ann. I wonder if she is that a lot of children who were, 8, 10, 12, remember that the first time they ever saw their parents or teachers cry openly was when Kennedy was shot on November 22nd. And one girl, who I quote in the book, came back to see her mother's tears sizzling on the iron as she tried to iron shirt.
Oh, my. What do you remember about that day, Ann?
Oh, well, I went to Catholic school, so I remember a lot of solemnity, a lot of tears, but the thing that really struck me as a young girl, as a little girl, was how much the whole world responded. That really, really struck me as I watched it on television.
Yes, Charles de Gaulle said he was shocked. He said, my God, he said to an advisor, they're crying all over France. It's as if he was a Frenchman, a member of their family. He was shocked by the grief in Paris. And the same thing happened in London, where teenagers were crying openly in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ann, so much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the decision to go to Dallas and the politics of all of that. It was 50 years ago, but to this day, it's still hard to read. You write about Jackie's thoughts that there were going to be a lot of rich Republican women at this luncheon, and she, I believe, had Jack help pick out what outfit she was going to wear.
Right, right. He said, you have to look good because you're going to be coming up against all these rich Republican women. It was a fundraising trip, but it was also a political trip. He wanted to energize the Democratic Party in Texas, which he was a bit distressed that he had to go there, that it was a state that should have been in his columns. Johnson, his vice president, was from Texas, but it wasn't. It wasn't a sure thing at all. So he was going for political reasons. He was going for fundraising reasons. He'd asked to go 2 years earlier. The John Connolly and some of the Texas Democrats were not particularly keen on having him come. There was a question about whether he should go to Dallas or skip Dallas. And of course, there were a number of warnings that came in about Dallas. And Dallas was kind of infamous then because Lyndon Johnson had been, and Lyndon and Lady Bird had been, really had a very ugly scene during the 1960 election when they came out of a fall after speaking, and a mob of Republican women that became known as the Mink Coat Mob because of the coats they were wearing, spat on Johnson. Adlai Stevenson went to give a speech on United Nations Day in October of 63 and was booed and shouted down and jostled when he left the hall and hit over the head a woman with a placard. And he felt that Kennedy shouldn't go. William Fulbright of Arkansas warned Kennedy about Dallas and told him, he said, I won't go to Dallas, you shouldn't go. He told him that at the beginning of October.
Mm-hmm.
But Fulbright was liberal on foreign affairs, and the conservatives in Dallas didn't like that. They called him a red louse.
But they went. And that whole...
But he went. I think he dreaded it more. He made remarks about a possible assassination, even the morning of his assassination, but he was often making comments like that. But he felt it would have been cowardly not to go. And once he went, he wanted people to be able to get close to him and see him, which he'd done when he went to Tampa a few days before. He didn't like the Secret Service getting between him and the crowd.
Was that reckless of him? To have that kind of contact with the crowds, do you think, or not?
It wasn't considered reckless at the time because we weren't as sensitive about this. And it wasn't as if he was surrounded and swarming, crowds were swarming over him. It was really having the Secret Service follow the car rather than, jog alongside, putting themselves between Kennedy and the crowd. But the crowd wasn't swarming the car. They were police lines and things keeping people back. And his feeling was that if somebody wanted to shoot him, and he said this several times, that somebody with a high-powered rifle from a roof could get him, which is what happened from a window.
Yeah. We're going to continue our conversation and welcome more phone calls. We're speaking this hour with the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. Thurston Clark is our guest. Thurston has written many other books, including a book on Bobby Kennedy and his 82 Days That Inspired America, Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. He's author of Pearl Harbor Ghosts and Lost Hero, a biography of Raoul Wallenberg. Our phone number for you to join our conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which, quite frankly, we like to read. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome more of your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And this hour we're spending with Thurston Clark. He is the author of JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. Before we go back to phone calls, I want to talk a little bit about JFK's wartime experience, because it was something that obviously he carried with him through his short life and through his presidency. I would imagine if you've been through war and if you've been decorated for what you've done and you've been brave during war, he thought about it, didn't he? And his brother, who he loved very much, who died during World War II.
Yes. His first near brush with death was when his PT boat, PT-109, was famously rammed by a Japanese destroyer. He lost two of his crewmen, and it took 5 days until they were rescued. The Navy believed that he had died, and he was very heroic. He swam for hours, towing a badly burned crewman with the man's strap from his life vest in his teeth to an island, and then he went and several times swam long distances trying to get help. He wasn't in combat, but he did come under combat afterwards, the captain of a PT boat that had been turned into kind of a gunboat, and he went to rescue some Marines who had been fighting in Choiseul Island, and he dropped them off and came back to pick them up, and a number had been killed, and they were wounded, and in fact, one young Marine died in his bunk. And this was a very formative experience for him, and afterwards he would like to say that they were all very keen, but when they went ashore, these Marines, but when men have tasted war, they're a lot less keen.
And he gave... I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was interested that he gave one of the badges from PT-109 to... He was generous in giving that to people who needed courage.
Yes, he was extremely... Kennedy had a very thoughtful side to him, which people who knew him well remarked on all the time. When he was in the hospital, walking down, he'd been summoned to Patrick's bedside, and he knew then that his son was dying. And he, as he walked through the ward of Children's Hospital in Boston, he saw a very badly burned baby, and asked the nurses what had happened, and he learned, and he said, "What's the name of the mother?" And then he took out a piece of paper and wrote her a note that said, "Keep up your courage, John F. Kennedy." And he said, "Please give this to her." He took time to do that when his own son was dying.
Yeah.
The PT-109 badge he gave to a boy in a wheelchair who had come to visit the White House, whose father had been killed in the war in a PT boat.
Yeah. Let's go to Paul in Madison next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest has any comments about JFK when he was in northern Wisconsin in October of 63 with Senator Gaylord Nelson. That was when he viewed the Apostle Island State Park.
Yes, and declared them
the National Conservation
Registry.
Tour.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the conservation tour, I think, in September of 63. That was a fascinating tour because he was started out speaking, delivering these prepared speeches about conservation, which was not a subject that particularly interested him. And most of the press wrote that he was pretty flat and not very stimulating. And some of the speeches, not the one in Wisconsin, but when he gave it might have been Wisconsin, but I think it was in Duluth, was one of the worst of his presidency. But then he suddenly ad-libbed a line or two about the test ban treaty and nuclear war when he was in Montana, which he thought would be Goldwater country, where nobody was going to hear about the test ban treaty. And he got an ovation and applause and cheers, and he suddenly realized that peace was going to be an important issue in the 64 campaign. And after that, he threw away his prepared speeches about conservation, and he talked about the test ban treaty and nuclear war.
Interesting. Thanks, Paul. Claire is next in Richland Center. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen, and Mr. Clark, hello to both of you.
Hi.
Mine is more of a remembrance, and I'm sure your guest will could comment on this, but I had you on the car radio as I was coming home, and I had remembered that as I ran in the house upstairs, I had a copy of the Stars and Stripes European edition when the president came, just a little bit prior to this, maybe 120 or 30 days. I'm looking at the picture on the limousine, and the date is, it's Wednesday, June 26, 1963, but my remembrance was that I was in an MP company in Heidelberg, Germany, and they call our units up to go more or less on to guard duty at a very small concern. And President Kennedy came there to review the troops. In fact, the entire armored division was standing at attention about 2 hours before he got there.
Oh.
And then as we were stationed along the street, and as he passed along, I dare say it was a very narrow street, and he went by in the convertible, and we were probably within certainly 30 feet of the car. We went up to be there that day, both as kind of military guards and to provide traffic control.
Hmm.
So possibly your guests might comment on that. I'm just noticing the headline on that next day said, the U.S. will risk its cities for Europe and Kennedy.
Hmm. That's quite a memory of that event. Thank you, Claire.
Yes, it's a wonderful memory. And military, a number in the military, when he died, there was terrible mourning at a lot of the camps and bases, because particularly the bases that were abroad, Italians and French and Germans and people would come to the bases with flowers and candles and things create a kind of memorial to Kennedy because it was an American facility and they wanted to show their grief.
Hmm. Boyd asks on email, when the Berlin Wall was being built, did that hurt his presidency? I believe it could also have led to a potential world war if things went differently.
Well, it did at the time, but he saw the Berlin Wall as a way to actually reduce tension with the Soviets, because it meant that the East Germans wouldn't be able to flee so easily to the West, and they were losing a lot of their most talented people. Kennedy was determined not to have it a cause of war, and he called up the reserves and he sent columns down the Autobahn to Berlin. He was not willing to start a nuclear war because the only way we could have stopped the Russians from doing it was nuclear weapons, because we were so weak compared to the Warsaw Pact forces in Europe. And that was the problem. Our conventional forces were so weak that they are our only way of stopping the Russians, I mean the East Germans, from building a wall would have been nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're almost to the end of the hour, Thurston. It still is. Isn't it amazing? So raw, particularly for people who are alive during that time.
No.
You can just start sobbing again if you think about it.
Yeah. No, the for me, I was 17 at the time, and I'll never forget the teachers who burst into tears, people who I thought were, and a lot of them were World War II veterans who've been through a lot of tough battles. And I remember particularly my Latin teachers just collapsing in tears.
Hmm. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. Thanks for writing the book.
Thank you very much for a very stimulating hour.
Thurston Clark, our guest this hour. His book is JFK's Last 100 Days, The Transformation of a Man and the Emergence of a Great President. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produce this program, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. A reminder that tomorrow We'll be talking about Medicare celebrating its 48th anniversary last week. Is it still controversial? Has it worked for everybody? It seems to be still wildly popular. Why is that? We'll talk about Medicare. And just a brief hello to the people we met last night at Boswell Books, who were there to hear Eugene Schultz and his memory of World War II. It was a lovely evening, and some listeners were there, and it was good to meet some of you. I've only talked to you on the phone. I saw you in person. So great conversations ahead. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening.